I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. I'm so excited to have Hillary McBride as my guest. I've heard her on other podcasts and was sort of insanely jealous that she wasn't on mine. And I thought that it would be so fun to have her talk about her new book called Mothers, Daughters, and Body Image, Learning to Love Ourselves as We Are. Hillary is a therapist, a clinician, and a PhD candidate at the University of British Columbia in counseling psychology. And this book, Mothers, Daughters, and Body Image, is just fantastic. We'll get into it a little bit here, but for anybody who's a mother or a daughter, and I was thinking, or maybe even a trans woman could really relate to this as well. I was just going over who might really resonate with this.
And,
and even for men who just want to understand this really foreign territory and have so few clues about it, it's such mothers and daughters relationship are so beautiful but complex and usually very complicated. How we decide things about ourselves and how society plays in. There's so much richness in this book. I know we'll just be getting just our tippy toes wet on this one. But as I was reading it, I really hadn't realized, I suppose, how alienated I was from my own body and the legacy of the mothers passing down to the daughters until I read your book. And I think women will be very surprised when they read this, I think, that the goggles that we wear, it's such a big aspect of that self-image. Maybe you can talk a little bit about some of those realizations you had as you were working on some of this material.
Yeah. You know, I'm just struck by your comment too, because I think such a big part of being a therapist is being aware of yourself and being aware of what's going on for the client in the room, and then helping them step into that awareness for themselves so that they can take responsibility for the life that they have and for the life that they want to have. And so it feels actually really honoring to hear you say that, that this book brought some awareness for you, because I think of that as being, in some ways, one of the ultimate tasks or responsibilities, to have a life that's actually free, a life that we feel is meaningful and rich and connected to ourselves and other people. So awareness is a big piece of what we do in therapy, and I guess, in a way, what can happen through this book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so you're asking about some of the awarenesses that I had while writing. Yeah, I think I had a few choices when writing this book and doing the research for this book about how honest I was going to be with myself about my own relationship with my body and my own relationship with my mom. And the motto that I use in therapy all the time is, I can't ask people to go places that I'm not willing to go. I can't ask people to be brave and be vulnerable and to self-examine if I, in my life or in certain areas of my life, refuse to do that. And so the choices that I had to make were painful and yet so valuable for me, because I got to learn while writing this in a new way. And I think to realize maybe some of the relationship wounds that were still there with my mom. And then to have hard conversations with her about those, to feel like I could write this book with integrity in a way that honored her and honored my story. And actually, there was a lot of healing that took place between her and I and within myself in writing this. So some readers, when they get to one of the last chapters about feeling emotions, see me struggle with the process of feeling emotions while writing the book. And so there is very much what we would call in therapy a parallel process of me learning and feeling and discovering along with the reader as I was nuancing and presenting the content.
That's such a fine line too. I was thinking about that as I got to that part, and I thought, oh my goodness, if I wrote a book about my mom, I would have to I don't know how I would do it. I don't know if I would be able to tell her about it, or just have to wait till she passes away, or to just, I don't know if we could have those conversations. And that you would use this as a time of healing, and that she could be a part of that process somehow. It was kind of astonishing and beautiful, but I know also had very painful points in it for you.
Very much so. You know, it's so interesting how this book has been very real as a marker of my own healing and my own process for me. It has invited me into deeper awareness for myself. Like I said, as I'm asking people to be aware for themselves as well. And I had this moment when writing the book where, well, I essentially always knew I was going to write it when I'd started my master's research and was doing the academic side of this, had made a commitment to myself that it wouldn't be this academic work that sits on a shelf, but it would be something that I would return to people as a way of saying, this is wisdom that we all need. These are stories that we all need to hear. This can't just be sitting in the ivory tower. So I always knew that I would write it. And when the opportunity came along to write it, I at some point had to confront the feeling that I wanted to be honest about my story, but I also felt this desire to protect my mother and not wanting to tell other people the truth about our pain unless she'd consented to that. Mm-hmm. But then I felt like I didn't know how to do that in a way that would honor her, but both be honoring to her and honest. Mm. So I sat down with her and had a conversation that for the rest of my life, I will be so, so glad that we had. Mm. It was transformative for the two of us, where I said to her, "Mom, I'm writing this book." And it was really a sit down conversation, a face to face encounter, if you will, where the two of us as adult women now were making a choice about the direction of our bond. I said to her, "I'm writing this book and I'm really scared because I don't want to hurt you, but I also feel compelled to tell the truth about my life. And that involves some of the things that you and I have been through." Mm-hmm. And historically, up until that point, I wouldn't have been sure how my mom would have responded. Mm-hmm. And because of some of the pain that she has carried, and I talk about that in the last part of the book, that she didn't have capacity to hold space for me and the way that I was figuring out who I was. Mm. And so often that made me feel like I had to silence myself. I had to disappear in my life and in our relationship, because I could see that me being fully me was very painful for her, that she didn't know how to hold space for that. So here I am saying, not only am I going to be me, but I'm going to tell the world about what it's like to be me. And how's that going to go for you when we haven't really done this well before? Mm. And she said to me something that has forever changed the trajectory of our relationship. She said, "You do not have to protect me from the pain that I feel about how I've hurt you."
Wow.
Yeah. That's like, even as I say those words now, I get shivers. I feel myself like start to tear a little bit, because it was a sign that I now is finally free in a way that I didn't have to be protecting her anymore. Because I think that's so much of what we do as daughters, often protect our parents from the truth about our behavior, you know, maybe even sexually, or our behavior, you know, the choices that we want to make in relationship or career trajectory, wanting them to be proud of us, not wanting to feel shame or feel their shame. And there was like this full release that she could handle her own feelings, and that if she had those feelings that maybe something was painful, or that she read something in the book and she felt regret, that she was able to handle that. And so I was now free to be exactly who I needed to be.
With that in mind, were you surprised at the maturity of that comment? Because to me, it almost seems like prior to that, or growing up, it was like almost like she had a stunting from her own mm-hmm. background. And then mm-hmm. that was sort of like the most mature thing she could have ever said.
Ever. Yeah. And I was surprised by it. And I also felt, just kind of in reflecting back on it a little bit later, felt little bits of sadness and longing that that was the kind of thing I needed to hear all along.
Yeah.
And so there was something redemptive in it, because it was like, this relationship has been righted, that there is something that was missing is finally in place. But then there's also sometimes grief with that of, whoa, there's missed opportunity. And I wonder what we could have had if there had been room for that all along.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing how people can change. I know a lot of times in therapy, too, and spiritual direction that I've done, you know, you're doing it based on the idea that people can change. And then a lot of times you don't find that to be as true as you wish it was, because people seem resistant to change. But then, you know, your parent sometimes grows up too in front of you, in a sense. Your book has case studies and interviews with moms and daughters. It's really powerful in that way, as of course it has your own story about your mom, and then it also has research about women and how they see themselves in the world, and different interesting studies and statistics. And also for people who are hearing this, there's really powerful reflection questions. So this book is thorough in that it's not just stories and some of your background, but like at the end you're really digging in internally, whether you're a daughter or also a mother, asking yourself about how you are passing things along to your daughter and how are you carrying on in the world that might pass along some of the same hurts. And that's a real added richness to the book. I think that it's therapeutic in itself. So I'm pleased that that's included, because that's the spiritual formation piece that I get, like, oh my goodness, there's reflection questions. Like, could this get any better? Like, it's not just like pleasure reading or like something that'll go away, but actually at the end you could be changed. So that's beautiful.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, no, I always wonder about how we can take information that we're learning and use that to aid in our transformation. And so whenever I'm teaching in a graduate program as well right now, and we'll often say, okay, so you learned something. Now what is that going to do about how you exist in the world and how you sit with your clients? And I feel like it's so important for us to take information that we hear the next step into the application place. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that reminds me of the ladders that you're talking about, how women can offer other women ladders, or their mothers can offer ladders to their daughters, or even the other way around. And I was thinking, you can talk a little bit about what that means a little more, but I was also thinking just this book could be also used in a small group of women too, or even of, if it's possible, families of women, like generationally, to think about how can we do better as women for each other, because we get a little isolated from each other. And I don't think we're realizing that we actually can offer ladders to each other.
Right. Yeah. So the idea of ladders would be akin to something that we say colloquially, like standing on the shoulders of giants, that there is something about what people have gone through before that allows the next generation, the next group to have something that those before them didn't have. So there's this propelling and this momentum towards growth and transformation, that the lessons that have been learned in our own lives can be passed on to other people as a way of helping them feel like they don't have to make the same mistakes, that they don't have to suffer in the way that we've suffered. Mm. And that doesn't mean that they won't suffer. Mm-hmm. Not at all. In fact, it might mean that you prepare them to suffer well. Mm. 'Cause I think that suffering is a part of life, that pain and loss and grief and despair, that those are not pathology, that those are part of being human. But how can we as women, how can we as humans equip each other to do that well? And how can we perhaps eradicate some of the unnecessary suffering. Mm-hmm. So I think that the latter's piece is about saying, I'm going to be aware enough of my own journey to support you, whoever you are, a friend, a child, a client, a student, maybe even a mother. Mm-hmm. I'm going to support you to learn from my story in a way that gifts you with my wisdom, mm-hmm. so that you do not have to wrestle for it in the way that I did, and that you can go on to wrestle with other things and to be your own person. Mm-hmm. And then to break the cycle of trauma, break the cycle of wounding as well, to say, I'm going to call out the story of the things that I've done, the things that have happened to me, and I'm going to take responsibility for my part of that so that I don't see you hurt in the way that I had to. Mm.
Yeah, some of the case studies have mothers handing their daughters ladders, or they might have had a really bad self-image because they might have been larger women, larger girls growing up, but their daughters actually didn't turn out to feel the same way about their larger right. bodies. And that idea that comes later on in the book about fat talk, and that is that women will sometimes bond over sharing their stories of body hatred, and how I was thinking, oh my goodness, that was like this Bible study I was in. It was like it always kicked off with like 15 minutes of I hate my body, and I'm going to have swimming seasons coming up. And I remember thinking, this is such a downer, but you know, here we are bonding over this really negative thing mm-hmm. based on how we feel, how our mothers have felt, how all the media coming at us is showing us what's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And yet some mothers are able to, even though they've had that in their own lives, are still able to hand down a ladder and allow their daughters in some way to have tools that don't get them stuck in those places.
Yeah. I think it takes a certain level of self-reflexivity to say, this is some shame that I carry. Mm. And instead of just playing out the shame without awareness, to keep having the same conversations over and over again, to say, this is something that I don't want for anybody else. Mm. The fact that I feel like I have to keep talking about how much I hate my thighs and how afraid I am of bathing suit season, I don't want that for anybody else. And so maybe I need to take responsibility to stop creating those kinds of dialogues, or to feel like that's the only way that I can feel close to other people. Mm. I think there's something so, so sad when I think about the way that we as women often feel close to each other, which is that we bond and find connection over this having similar experiences of body hatred. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's so much more for us than to keep each other stuck in that way. Mm-hmm. And there's also something about it which is kind of competitive. I'm sure you've probably heard, whether it's been in conversations you've had or somebody else, someone saying, oh, I hate this part. And, you know, I don't like my cellulite, or, mm-hmm. you know, I wish that I just didn't have that spare tire around my stomach. And other women saying, you think that's bad? Oh, man, whatever it is. And then we kind of one up each other with how much we hate our bodies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As if like there's some sort of prize to be won by the person who feels the most shame.
Mm. Yeah. Another thing I wanted to discuss a little bit with you is related to that same sort of thing in self-worth and beauty, but also as it relates to being chosen, and how, this also relates to, it's very, very sad to say, and I'd love for you to speak into this specifically, because once again, I have a daughter that's 15, mm-hmm. and all her peers for sure have been raised on a steady diet of pornography. They have had access to smartphones since they were six, and it's really easy to get those pictures until you have these idealized forms that they're very rarely minority bodies pictured or mm-hmm. anything other than a very slim physique, and there are of course no disabled people mm-hmm. pictured. And so immediately you're being judged against these very narrow specifics for the standard of beauty. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, like you were talking about, self-objectification and putting yourself against these things. And I think wanting to be chosen, and then crumbling, their self-worth potentially crumbling, and then a lot of judgment going around. And it's really in the air in a different sort of way than it was 20 years ago.
Mm. Yeah, with the just kind of the appearance and image focus, it's there's some really, really awful things that can happen for people when they live their lives seeing images of other people. Because with the kind of explosion of smartphones and social media, generally most of that, I mean, if you think of things like Snapchat or Instagram, mm-hmm. most of that is image-based. Mm-hmm. It's not idea-based or text-based or experiential. Mm-hmm. It's seeing things. And often if we're not sure if we're enough, but we see that somebody else feels really good about themselves, or we perceive that they feel really good about ourselves or good about themselves, then all of a sudden there becomes some sort of standard or expectation. Maybe I'd feel good about myself if I looked like that. And so I think that there's, I don't think media is bad per se. I don't think images are bad, but I think we need to be so careful, especially for developing humans, young women, young men, about how they interact with images and then what happens internally for them in response to seeing all of those images. What happens to them about what they expect of themselves, what they expect of other people, what becomes ideal, what they feel like they desire for themselves or other people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what you were talking about with media literacy, and trying to understand, sort of what's real and what's not, what is beauty really, and those are tough to navigate. Probably no matter what your age, if you have a sense of shame and feelings of inadequacy and things like that, but it's that much worse when you're sort of surrounded by everybody sort of buying into the same.
There's so much, there's so much more to fight if we feel like our belonging is at stake, mm-hmm. if we don't agree with those other ideas. Mm-hmm. So we're social creatures and we desire to belong. And if we feel like our health is in conflict with our belonging needs, more often than not, we're going to choose our belonging needs. And so we want to be a part of a group of people, even if that costs us something internally or costs us something about our feelings about ourselves. So it can be really helpful to find groups of people who you can belong to that represent perhaps more healthy versions of being human. Because we all desire to feel like we're a part of something that's hardwired into us to want to be seen and to be known. And generally, if we're not getting that in healthy ways, or if we're not getting that from people who support our health and development, we're going to get it from whoever we can get it from.
Mm-hmm. That kind of leads me to some of the things you were talking about regarding embodiment.
Yeah,
I love speaking about embodiment, because I think there are a lot of ways we try to, or we will unknowingly separate our body from our minds.
And
we think that they're actually different. You know, there's the me that appears out to people. Then there's the me thinking about that me.
Right,
Maybe you can talk a little bit about what you mean regarding embodiment.
Well, I think often when we, especially people who've grown up in the church or people who've grown up in kind of empiricist Western society, have this dualistic perspective of the self. There is a mind or a soul, and then there is the body, and these are distinct entities. And I think we've constructed the idea of the self, which actually inhibits fully being in our bodies and fully existing in this world. Mm. So embodiment is about not just enjoying our appearance, which is a great thing to do, but really living in your body, to notice that your body is actually a very important part of being you. It perhaps isn't the sum of who you are, because there are certainly people who have bodies who will think of a person who is no longer alive. There is a body there, but there is no essence of the person. But we can be disembodied as we move through the world as well, almost as if we're just our thoughts or just our cerebral activity. Mm. So embodiment really means existing as a body in the world and seeing how the self is connected intimately with the experiences of the body. For example, whatever happens to me as a person happens through my body. I don't exist without my body. I don't exist as just these neural activities in a vacuum. I feel pleasure in my body. I can be active or inactive in my body. And so to have more appreciation for what it means to exist as a full self means that it opens us up to feeling our feelings deeper, having more gratitude about what it means to be human, maybe even feeling the pain and loss of disability more. But it moves the identity away from appearance and away from thought to a more integrated perspective of the self.
Mm. It does connect too with these masks that we can put on, feel disembodied. Mm-hmm. And so we're not thinking, in fact, the self, that projected self is a construct, and it's, right, it's a false one, and it can be like a real hostile, debilitating construct.
Yeah.
And then you can have like, but who is the real you? It's probably, right, the you that's observing the false you, right? So that's the real you. It would be the empowered, enlivened you that can look at all the false yous, you know, and can, mm-hmm, kind of, the embodied self would be comfortable and know the appetites and desires, like you were talking about in some of those things.
Yeah.
But is like, oh, I'm here, I'm experienced, I can feel the sun on, mm-hmm, my skin. And it's just in this moment. And then the false selves or the constructs would be like, I wonder if that person's thinking this about me. I wonder, you know, right, is my hair out of place? Did I put on a little weight? You know, and those false constructs are these like shadow false selves or.
Sure. Yeah. That's one way of looking at it, or, preoccupations or kind of disembodied, self-critiqued.
Yeah.
There are lots of different ways of looking at it, but all of those, the self-criticisms, the evaluation of appearance, the preoccupation with other people, mm-hmm, has very little to do with the here and now. It has very little to do with being fully yourself. It has more to do with these questions that often stem from, am I enough and do I belong? Mm. And to feel at home in the body is to feel fully alive, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That there is life lives in the body and the mind and is relational and is individual. And it's all of these things.
Mm.
The more that we get kind of in academia into what is mind and what is self, it gets very messy because we have very, very mixed ideas depending on the discipline or the lens that you're looking at about, mm-hmm, how to answer that question. But generally, mm-hmm, it comes back to being embodied,
mm-hmm,
and having an autobiographical story about yourself, mm-hmm, and to feel yourself in relationship with other people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that when our needs for belonging and our needs for value are compromised, then all sorts of things happen where we're doing, what we call, maybe we're playing games or we're doing funky things to try and make up for those needs not being met. And often that pulls us out of our lived experience and out of our body.
Mm.
Like when you think about kids developmentally, they are fully in their bodies. There is no cerebral activity and preoccupation with, am I inconveniencing mom right now when I'm screaming in the middle of the night because my belly feels empty?
Mm.
Like, no way. The emotion is visceral. The body is being lived. And to be adults, we learn how to control our impulses, and we learn how to notice what's going on for our body and to have some mastery over it. But to do that in a way that doesn't pull us out of our body is very complex. Mm. But I think one of the ways to not only existentially be fully alive, but to make peace with our body is to be in it, to not just see it from the outside, but to see it from what it is, for what it is. Mm. Like if you think about a relationship, I don't want a relationship that exists on a TV screen where I'm watching it from the outside. I want a relationship where when I'm hurting, my partner comes and comforts me and we laugh together and we experience new things together. Mm. And that's the kind of differentiation that I'm talking about, of not just seeing your body like you're seeing it on a screen, but living in your body and having experiences in it and feeling all of the things that go along with it as a way of helping you move towards more fullness. And maybe even towards more gratitude for what it is to be alive, what it is to be a body.
Mm. Yeah. It reminds me of a number of years ago, a friend of mine who goes to my church had terminal liver cancer. And she, in the last weeks of her life, was so careful with her body because she knew it was going to be over soon. So she would care for her face. She would care for her body in loving ways. Yeah. And I thought that's because she's almost done with her body, you know? But how often do we don't think about it, you know, we're just going on. Yes. You might think about your body when you get injured or in some kind of pain, but maybe not until then, you know.
Yeah.
But that, you know, you're talking about some of those things, and really self-care plays into this. But, you know, about how hard are we scrubbing our teeth or our face? And are we really treating our body with the care that, you know, you're just getting one? So,
are we reenacting the discipline and the punishment of the body that we see displayed in culture? Yeah. Are we trying to have mastery over something? Mm. Or are we trying to experience and love and inhabit it? Mm-hmm. And I think we exist in a culture which, I mean, there's lots of feminist theorists who would articulate this more clearly, but we observe in a patriarchal society the punishment and the suppression and the mastery over the female body, that there is there is like a corseting of the body and consequently a corseting of the self. There's a wanting to restrict or wanting to discipline, punish, kind of
subdue.
And how then as women we often internalize that and reenact that in our own relationships with our body, that we, you know, we discipline them and we restrict our food intake, or we work out because we feel shame and we want our bodies to be more controlled instead of so unruly. We get angry with our bodies when they don't perform the way that we want them to, or they don't appear the way we want them to, instead of seeing that we are our body and our body is this beautiful gift that helps us move as a self throughout the world.
Hmm. That plays into what I was going to talk about next, which is the silencing the self and voice and being able to take a break. You talk about learning to rest means taking a break from all of the running I've done in my life, especially running away from painful feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm feeling as you say that evokes some emotion in me, because that's been such a struggle that I think as women, we learn often to be compliant and then to almost disappear in our own lives. Mm-hmm. I think that people who've grown up in the church or different different religious or spiritual communities, sometimes there is a component of being a part of that community that says if you're a good woman, you need to be present but not challenging. Mm. You need to be appreciated for your beauty or your appearance or your function, but don't take up too much space. Mm. And so we learn to not disagree. We learn to not engage in conflict or conversation, or we learn to not challenge others because it's inconvenient for them. And so there's often a suppression of the self that goes on, as I mentioned earlier, as a way to secure a sense of belonging, that I want to know that I matter in this community and that I'm good Mm-hmm. And so I'm gonna sort of disappear in order to get that. Mm. But that costs us something. Mm. That costs us having a full life. That costs us having real relationships. That costs us existing in the world in a way that other people can benefit and learn from our journeys and our struggles. It stops us from moving justice forward. I mean, depending on what feminist camp you stand in, some people would say that preoccupation with the body is a function of the oppression of women because it keeps us preoccupied with how we look instead of with challenging systems of power.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, it's like if you're, don't be troublesome, but make sure you smile. And,
yeah.
You know, and you're talking, this is a fantastic piece on page 133. Mm. It says, the most interesting analysis I ever heard of eating disorders and what's going on for the woman who's struggling with disordered eating is that eating disorders can be about trying to restore social power. Mm-hmm. And that relates to that, but maybe you could flesh that out a little bit more.
Yeah, well, there's that. I think for people who don't understand eating disorders, they think it's about vanity. They think it's about appearance. They think it's about exclusively someone who just wants to be thin or a different size or whatever. Mm-hmm. But really what we know is that in a world which tells women that their social power is limited to how they look, that it's interesting that this kind of illness, if you will, is socially reinforced. Women are saying, well, okay, I'm going to do everything you told me to do. Mm-hmm. And then maybe I'll be valuable. Or, I mean, another way of looking at it is to say, like, I'm going to be powerful in my own control of my body and do exactly what you told me to do as a way of feeling like I have some agency back in my life because I have no power anywhere else except to control my food intake or to control my weight. So if eating disorders aren't about vanity, then what are they about? And when we look at the social context in which they emerge most often, we see it's in a context where women are reminded that they're not valuable unless they're thin and young and healthy and beautiful and sexy. And that's the summation of women's worth in our culture. And so it's interesting to see it kind of from two angles, that the preoccupation with weight could be actually women saying, okay, I'm going to play that game. I'm going to do that. I'm going to feel like I'm doing everything you're actually telling me to do, but get kind of sick in response. Or women saying, like, I feel so disempowered by that discourse that I'm going to do everything I can to get some power back, but here's the only way I know how to. Mm-hmm. Which is, it fits into our understanding clinically of eating disorders being a really normal response to the experience of trauma, sexual trauma, relational trauma, that trauma is disempowering. It is going through an experience which makes us feel confused, overwhelmed, and powerless. And having a disrupted sense of agency in the body, that somehow what it means to be human has been diminished, that someone has taken away what it means to be alive and to be valued as a person. And so I'm going to do what I can in this moment. And I say I'm going to do what I can as a description of the process as opposed to kind of an explicit and declarative statement that someone might make. Mm-hmm. That there is a movement of the self towards trying to regain some power or maybe even to respond to the trauma by saying, you don't think I'm valuable? Okay, I'm going to disappear then.
Mm. What's the process that people take? Obviously, it's going to be very different for each person, but what is the process of untwining that idea, because it can seem, I'm sure, very powerful if there's nothing you can control in your life, but then lo and behold, here you could lose like 25 pounds and it feels, and then somebody might be like, hey, you look really good. And you could think, yeah, I do, don't I? In the sense of like, yeah, I got to control that all by myself. And exactly. I don't have control over, I don't know, overbearing partner or something else spiraling out of control. But then this one thing mm-hmm. with food intake or over exercise or whatever,
yeah.
you did have power. And so then yeah. how that must reinforce it. And then how do people yeah. tend to get a handle on the destructiveness of that or undoing that response?
Yeah, well, I think people need to find other ways of feeling powerful. We need to find other ways of feeling like we have value and worth besides appearance. And those two things together of like having agency outside of controlling our eating or having disordered eating is important. But also to say, I am so much more than how I look or what happens to my body or what I do to my body. That I have value in this world just because I'm human and I have something to offer. And so I can continue to engage in life and in the world because I have now shifted the focus of my worth from body appearance, from body function to being a whole person. So pushing back on those sociocultural narratives, I think, is important in addition to having some sort of return of agency. I remember the first time in my recovery from eating disorder when I knew that I was really progressing towards healing was when I started to get angry.
Because you felt you weren't allowed to be angry?
Well, it was a bit about that, but I think just I wasn't allowed to be. And anger is such a visceral emotion. And to be angry about the injustice of a world in which I would be sick, but people would see that as being valuable in some ways, and then would at some point that would become pathology because it was no longer valuable because I was too thin. That my worth and value was so much about my body and how it appeared to other people and how I'd internalized that. And so being angry about that process, being able to then feel my anger, being able to express my anger was my way of knowing or was allowed me to know that I was now a self again, that I had my own ideas, that I had my own opinions and that I could be more fully me. Because often in recovery too, what happens is there is a reinforcement of compliance. So do what we're telling you to do. Eat these many meals a day. Stop this behavior. Stop that behavior. Do this. Don't think that way. And in a way, I think it reinforces the lack of agency that women have in their own lives, that we can often, if eating disorders are a symptom of disrupted agency, but then to recover from an eating disorder, we have to then kind of again, in another way, take away a person's agency. I don't know if we can ever help them become fully alive again.
Oh, yeah.
So my ability to go, I'm over this. And actually, there was one occasion where I was being expected to go into a residential treatment program, and I chose not to. And it felt like an act of healing for me to say, whoa, I get to participate in my own story. I get to decide that I don't want something and that that's okay. And here are some reasons why I don't want that. And it felt to me like a symbol that I was existing again.
The idea of being like continually disempowered and then losing yourself it takes different forms for people. You know, some people might go into addiction or maybe just even overeating and disappearing into unattractiveness. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to be seen. I'm not going to be, because there's something sometimes about being wanted, and then there's something about I'm going to eliminate that from the choices.
Well, I was just thinking, I'm sitting here looking at my bookshelf, and there's a book called Fat is a Feminist Issue by Susie Orbach, and it's a seminal feminist text in that she talks about how when women have felt consistently violated by male violence or the male gaze or patriarchy and what that says about women's bodies, that sometimes fat is an act of rebellion. It's a way to say, I am going to not be everything that you've told me to be, or it might be an act of protection. If you don't see me because I'm not part of the group of people that you determine attractive, then maybe I'm finally safe.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really that's a choice. That then it gets to be a choice. But it's still a wound, you know. So, I guess and being able to, and I think maybe people aren't going there in their head. They're not really tweezing that out and understanding it. But they're just kind of, that they don't maybe necessarily have that self knowledge. But if they were to look deep and find out what's hurting them and what's wounding mm-hmm. them, and sometimes I eat my feelings. Mm-hmm. I'll go for the sweets. I'll go for the pastries, and I'll think, why am I eating? I'm not hungry. You know, And because we all are wounded, and then we find different ways to cope with it in different ways. But you talk about it towards the end of the book. You talk about the common role that spirituality plays in the case studies, and the protective nature that it seems to have in people who have overcome some of their issues, and maybe you could relate in your life or what you see are some patterns, and also defining beauty in a different way and the divine. And it would be great if you could weigh in a little on that.
Yeah, well, I think like we actually academically have a lot of evidence to say that there is there are some damaging aspects of religious traditions mm-hmm. that sometimes being told you have to comply and you have to be good, and if you're not good, then you're not enough and you're going to hell, that those experiences can be disembodying and shaming and silencing for women. So religion, capital R, or religious traditions aren't necessarily protective. In some cases, they could be. They could be giving a sense of belonging and meaning and purpose in life, but we don't really have enough evidence to say that they are exclusively good or exclusively bad. But interestingly, I didn't have any intention of asking women in this study that I did about their religious or spiritual traditions. That wasn't really a part of what I was asking about. And yet all of the women, especially the young women who said, I feel embodied, I feel like I love my body, I feel like it's good for me to be alive, and I'm okay with who I am, and I actually love myself, spoke about having this relational, spiritual identity, that there was something bigger than them, God, divine, universe, Jesus, whatever it was that made them feel like over and above culture, that they were seen and known and loved, and that there was an entity or a force or a being that said, I see you and I love you and you're good. Mm. So this personal relational experience with something bigger was protective for these women, because it allowed them to say, when everyone around me is saying that I'm not enough, that I have a source that I can go back to continually that reminds me, no, I am enough, and I am enough just as I am. Mm. And so it's not I'm enough because I'm proving to this bigger identity that I'm good, but it's this bigger entity, I should say, so this divine, this God was empowering them to feel like there was already enoughness within them. Mm. And so they didn't have to go on this search to strive for enoughness as it was defined by our sociocultural or sociopolitical ideals.
Hmm. Well, that's really interesting, because it's sort of inoculates them against some things, but it's also, that's actually like a lived out grace. Like,
right.
They're able to refer to something else and they experience a grace. And that's which you can't often do if you're just referring to another person who's gonna mm-hmm. may or may not come through for you, you know, that may have conditional love, or may want you to, you know, put on more blush, or you know, whatever it is. But if you have a source outside that is just a loving source, and that it has already accepted you, then you can say, well, I might not feel great today about myself, and I, you know, maybe look fat in these jeans, but I know that this divine source is a source of love to me, and I can rely on that now.
Yeah, and I can resource myself with that when everybody else is either silent about my worth mm-hmm. or is speaking against my worth, mm-hmm. that I have a place I can go to source mm. whatever that source is, mm-hmm. as a way of feeling like I can be restored in and righted, and I can be, my self-perception can be healed. It's kind of like going back to home base. Like, this is the story about who I am. I'm enough. And when I go out and I live in the world and everything says otherwise, I can always come back to this divine source of love, this God of mine who says, don't worry about that. Mm-hmm. Their opinions don't matter in the way that mine do. Mm-hmm. And I see you as being loved and being enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to remind you of that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's a very stabilizing force. And yeah, that is interesting. And you just stumbled on that when you weren't going after that information.
No. Yeah. And in academic research, I mean, mm-hmm. particularly about feminist academic research, it's, mm-hmm. it can be kind of a touchy thing to talk about mm-hmm. religion or spiritual experiences, because so often they've been shaming and oppressive to women. Mm-hmm. And yet this was something that the data showed. It was something that the women spoke about. And mm-hmm. to be a good, an empirical academic researcher, you have to report what the participants disclose. And mm-hmm. this to them was important. Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily think that everyone's going to identify with it, mm-hmm. but isn't it interesting that every single person, without me seeking it out, who was in the study, spoke about this and that it was important to them. And maybe there's that says something about what we need as humans in order to thrive. We need to know about our enoughness. We need to know that we belong, that we are valued and loved. And for people who don't identify with a spiritual tradition or faith practices, perhaps there for them is another way of trying to get that.
Mm. Yeah. This has been amazing, Hillary. I hope you'll come on again sometime, and you don't even have to write a book or anything.
Woo, good. Thank you so much for your time, Lisa. It's been such a joy to share about these things, and I so appreciate your interest in the subject and in my story. And I'm really hopeful that people listening to this conversation might identify with some of the things that we talked about and then be able to move into feeling more freedom in their own lives and in their bodies. Mm.
It's a great step to engage the material in this book and talk about it with other women. I think that's a fantastic starting point wherever you are in the process of loving or hating your body. And there's just, women are complex with everything we encounter through our connections and through, you know, the media situation that comes into our lives. There's just a lot to take in, and I think this will provide just a lot of healing and things to think about. I'm so thankful that you would write this. And I also want to mention that as this comes out, the book is available for pre-order already, and then it'll be out at the end of October of this October 2017, in case you're listening to this in, you know, the distant future or something. But yeah. Now, do you have an answer for My Body Is?
The more I think about it, I answer that question differently depending on where I'm at. Sometimes there's an adjective. My body is good. My body is joy. My body is life. Today I feel like my body is me. I'm just here. I'm just in it. I'm just alive. I'm with myself. I'm not mm-hmm. outside of myself reflecting back on myself. I'm just me here sitting with you talking. Mm-hmm. So that's how it is today.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You're here. You're where you are.
I am. Yeah. I'm in myself. I'm just living, and it feels good.
Yes. Throughout the book, Hillary asks different people, "My body is," and it's amazing how you know, different people respond. And when I got some terrible answers I was asking myself at the beginning of reading it, and I was like, dang, maybe it's time to go back to counseling. because you don't think about that. My body is, then you just answer it. And the first thing that would come to my mind were not nice things. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the time of you know, you don't think, I guess, you don't think sometimes, at least as a woman or at least as me, that hating on your body is hating yourself.
Yeah.
And that self-loathing is hating your who you are and I and you're not realizing how destructive it actually is. And I think that you're not going to help, you're not going to be able to help anybody out to the degree that you can't address those things for yourself. And it gave me pause to really think, you know, what am I doing? What am I thinking about myself? And how can I be more comfortable as who I really am? You know, whatever imperfections there are, that's not like, it's not like I get to redo it. Even if I had plastic surgery, there would still be problems. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not about it's not about the externals. And I think that's why people keep having the surgeries. They're like, that didn't work.
Right. I want it to fix. I'm going to fix something on the inside by fixing something on the outside. And
there's still something wrong because the hatred is still there.
Yeah.
So there's a lot. Wow. There's a lot to chew on with this whole topic, and you know, we kind of barely scratched the surface.
So people have to read the book.
Exactly. I mean, all the discussions that could come from reading this book, it would be amazing. But you know, you should do like Facebook Lives and stuff like that. Have you thought about?
I haven't necessarily thought about doing that, but I've got some groups of women kind of in the Vancouver area who are going to be meeting and doing book clubs, and then I'm going to go either visit them live or by social media or, sorry, by Skype or FaceTime to join them on the final conversation about their about the book and final conversation in their book club together. And so if people are interested in that, if I have availability, I'd be so happy to be able to join in by phone or FaceTime or Skype if they wanted to have a discussion group about the book after reading it.
Yeah, tell everybody where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find me on my website, HillaryLMcBride.com. There should be three L's in there because there's two L's in my first name. So HillaryLMcBride.com. And there's a contact me button and you can shoot me an email. And because of the volume of emails that I get, I'm not necessarily going to respond the same day. So if you are planning something a little bit of a ways out, then that would be perfect timing. And if it works for me with my school and clinical schedule, I'd be happy to join people in conversations about the book in their book clubs or whatever it is.
Yeah, that would be really neat to get a couple questions together and throw them your way. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Hillary. Again, I'll get this out on the 18th. So this has been so fun. Thank you.
Good. I'm so, this is my counselor part and my fellow traveler part. I'm so impressed and inspired by the depth that you went to in your reflection while reading the book, because that's a choice that you had to make to go to some of those hard places. Mm-hmm. And like, wow, what a gift to give yourself that experience. So way to go, Lisa.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm so happy that you're proud of me, Hillary.
Yeah.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.